Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Today is the deadline for Americans with money stashed in secret offshore bank accounts to declare those funds to the IRS. There are billions hidden abroad. 52,000 American accounts with Swiss bank UBS alone. American fortunes wooed into secret overseas vaults to duck the tax man. Now the hallowed tradition of Swiss secrecy has been cracked. Names are being named. Come clean and avoid even bigger trouble, the IRS is saying. And more than 7,500 U.S. citizens have come forward to disclose assets, unload their conscience, and avoid jail time and bigger fines. Other big fish are betting they won't get caught. This hour On Point, cracking down on wealthy offshore tax evaders. You can join the conversation. Have you had a billion stashed abroad? How should we deal with those who do? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average hitting 10,000 yesterday. But first, for the latest on the IRS crackdown on offshore assets hidden, we'll go to Carrick Mullenkamp, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He joins us from Atlanta. Thanks for being there, Carrick.
Hi, Tom.
You've done a lot of reporting on this. 7,500 taxpayers now voluntarily disclosing that they have secret offshore accounts. What's propelling them forward, Carrick?
Well, I think it's become this interesting fear factor. I don't think they want to go to prison or even have that sitting in their conscience. And the IRS has given them up until today to come forward and not be prosecuted. So they had to kind of figure out, do they want to run the risk that they could end up being criminally prosecuted, or is it just better to come forward, pay a fine, pay the taxes you owe, and get it over with? And nearly 8,000 have decided that.
Give us the backdrop to this crack in the wall of Swiss banking secrecy that brought this all forward. It all goes back to an investigation, a whistleblower at UBS, the big Swiss bank that, what, had agents all over the United States at yacht clubs and polo matches and wine tastings, recruiting rich Americans to essentially hide millions, billions abroad.
UBS was there were kind of three pockets of the U.S. they had targeted before the whistleblower came forward. That was Miami during the Art Basel festival there. Newport, Rhode Island, California were kind of three key areas where they focused. And it's hard to believe, but this goes back more than 2 years now to about June of 2007 when UBS banker Bradley Birkenfeld came forward to IRS and, mm-hmm. and met in June of 2007, and then a few months later met with the Senate investigators, and that started to unravel everything. Mr. Birkenfeld had joined the bank in 2001, had seen some things that raised questions in his mind. He had participated in some of the tax shelters for clients and started to come forward in 2007, and really it kind of opened the door up for the IRS. That's kind of the pivotal moment. They were making inroads, but that's the critical point in time is mid-2007.
They never had quite such a clear view of how deliberate and specific and explicit this all had been. I mean, diamonds being smuggled for wealthy Americans in toothpaste tubes into Swiss vaults so that the value could be sunk there away from the eyes of the IRS. And we're talking big money here, billions in dollars overall.
But yeah, potentially. I think that the diamonds in the toothpaste was a kind of salacious one-off, but there's no question that the UBS bankers were coming in from Zurich or Geneva and taking very careful steps as they had been trained to come in looking like tourists, don't leave documents in hotel rooms, you know, lock your computer, don't carry client names with you, shred everything that you have. So they were taking obvious moves to hide everything, and now billions of dollars are at stake.
I'm reading here a note in Tax Notes, kind of a professional newsletter on all this.
Sure.
And Switzerland is a respectable, developed European country that acts like a tropical island that feeds off tax evasion by U.S. citizens. How did the IRS get enough leverage on Switzerland to break open the secrecy, which has been a hallmark of Swiss banking for such a long time?
there's a small group, and you'll and one of your guests later can talk about this group better than I can, but there's a small group out of the IRS in the late 90s, early 2000 or so, that had started to work towards trying to crack offshore bank secrecy. And what they latched onto was that they that these offshore U.S. citizens that were clients of offshore banks had U.S. credit cards that were being processed through the U.S. So their account would be offshore, but they would have a U.S. credit card. When they needed to pay down that credit card debt, they would use the offshore account. What the IRS latched onto was the fact that we could they could subpoena the credit card processors as a way in the back door. And if it, it, what would ended up filing what they would end up calling a John Doe summons, which is they don't know the names, but it allows them to do a wide net. So that was working in their favor as they move forward in trying to understand the institutions behind the offshore accounts.
And now it's a real deadline extended from September the 23rd, but they say they won't extend it again. That says, fess up about what you've stashed there away from the eyes of the tax man. And pay a fine, or we'll come in and you'll be subject to much bigger fines, maybe more than the value of what you have stashed, and potentially to prison time.
Yeah. Yeah, today's the day. They extended it once, probably because they knew more people were trying to get in the door. It, we've talked to a number of tax lawyers that as the first deadline, the September 23rd deadline loomed, tax lawyers were effectively faxing over documents to the IRS to get their clients in the door, and the IRS extended it so that they could potentially get more in. And they probably got a couple thousand at least, I would think, in the during the time of the extension to today.
We're going to hear from a tax attorney in this hour. We've seen many quoted saying they've got clients that are just freaking out, wanting to avoid the big penalty, but others willing to play the odds because the Swiss are not revealing all the names. 52,000 accounts, but only 4,450 that they've given or will give to the IRS, Carrick?
Correct. It's about 4,000. The 52,000 is a number that's been out there. The IRS cited it. That could be where a client has several accounts. And so it may not be 52,000 people.
But accounts?
A U.S. citizen could have three or four accounts. The way these were set up, they were layered accounts, UBS accounts that were tied to kind of fictional companies, say in Liechtenstein or Hong Kong, and those might require separate accounts to make to work out the money flow before the money could be repatriated back into the U.S. without the IRS seeing it.
Carrick Mullenkamp with the Wall Street Journal. Please stand by in Atlanta. Joining us as well now from Rochester, New York, is David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, was senior tax reporter for a long time at the New York Times. He's author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. David K. Johnston, welcome back to On Point.
Well, thank you for having me on, Tom.
What's going on here?
Well, we are clearly making significant progress in addressing a very large problem in which wealthy people who want to cheat the government have been able to do so pretty much with impunity. We are nowhere near solving the problem. And we don't have the resources to prosecute even 4,400 people. In the whole of the United States last year, there were roughly 700 convictions for criminal federal tax fraud. And what we have, I've written in Tax Notes, where I'm a columnist, what we have is a program of catch and release. If you look at the amount of uncollected taxes in real terms, it's doubled in the last 8 years. Gone up enormously. It's now at $94 billion. This is money the government has gotten taxpayers to acknowledge they owe, but it hasn't collected. And it's doubled because Congress has cut the resources to audit and elsewhere. Now, we had this very smart unit of people who figured out ways to start busting things loose. We've had one Swiss banker who came forward. And in another case, there's the fellow in Liechtenstein who sold material to the German government, and they've been cooperating with the U.S. government in identifying tax cheats as well. So things are better, but they are a long, long way from being solved.
Yet here is nevertheless one big crack in the wall. And what do we see? What's the pattern been, David K. Johnston, of how these accounts have been used by Americans of means, substantial means?
Well, Carrick caught one of them very clearly, and that was this credit card thing where you would draw cash from an ATM machine and have high-level cash authority so you could easily draw thousands of dollars from multiple locations in a day. That's one. Secondly, the use of these offshore accounts to pay bills through nominees. A number of years ago, a retiring IRS agent told me about someone who had what appeared to be spotlessly clean tax returns with a five-figure income, and he actually had millions of dollars of income, and he owned buildings in the United States through a foreign entity, and he was renting space in one of his buildings and taking it as a business deduction when it was actually going to himself offshore. There are a lot of these devices that are out there. The Swiss banks are simply part of this problem.
And now the IRS opening new offices around the world trying to get a handle on this thanks to a whistleblower. I mean, the basic idea is stash your money out of reach, out of sight, secretly, and you're not taxed on it. Make a fortune, stash it away, and the sort of the guy with the money coming out of his little weekly paycheck is paying his taxes, but you're not.
That's exactly right. I mean, we have two tax systems in America, separate and unequal. One is for wage earners, where the government knows everything you make and can properly tax you. And the other is for investors, landlords, and business owners. Congress trusts these people to accurately report and does very, very little auditing of them. Now, it is important to keep in mind, Tom, there is nothing illegal about having a foreign bank account.
Right.
You only have to disclose it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about tax evaders, the billions hidden in offshore tax havens, and the IRS move to crack down. Today is the deadline for hidden offshore account holders to come clean, with Carrick Mollenkamp of The Wall Street Journal, who has followed this story, and David K. Johnston, who's followed tax issues in this country for years. We'll hear in just a moment from a tax attorney right in the middle of all this business. Let's hear from a few callers first. Hank in Morrisville, Vermont. Hank, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. This is a great program. It's democracy at its best. And my comment is about Halliburton having moved to Dubai, Italy. I mean, Dubai, not Italy.
To Dubai, yeah.
Tax-free. And Dick Cheney's company pretty much moving out of our country after his election, his term was up, is a big smack in the face to all the taxpayers of the U.S.
What do you think about Swiss bank accounts that are not declared, that sort of duck the tax man?
Absolutely horrible. I mean, we should have a flat tax in this country, 22%. I pay 29% as a small business owner here in Vermont, and it's a smack. They have so many tax shelters. You know, they try to tax shelter millions of dollars. I tax shelter $3,000-$4,000 a year. And then the market goes down, and that money's gone.
Yep, and good luck to you. Thanks for calling, Hank. Let's go to Detroit, Michigan, and Michael. Michael, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Pretty well. What do you think, Michael?
Well, I think, first of all, people should do their homework about who they are themselves versus the IRS. First of all, we have to understand that this is the whole system is a corrupt system to begin with. And I might have thought to anybody who know their rights and know that they don't have to pay taxes to begin with.
Well,
and
who says?
It's just like any other bag man, a third party whom you have no idea that you're giving your money to is saying that you, by law, have to pay them money for your hard-earned money.
So, Michael, do you admire the people who may hide, you know, thousands, hundreds, thousands, millions abroad?
Well, see, they're not hiding anything because here's the deal. They've earned that money one way or another, and they owe no homage to anyone. That's just like if I just came along and told you that you owe me a portion of your money for the good of someone else.
Michael, I want to pick that up with a tax attorney right now, if I may, and thanks for your call. H. David Rosenblum joins us. He's an attorney at Kaplan & Drysdale, director of the International Tax Program at the New York University School of Law, represents some clients who have offshore accounts. He's former director of the Office of International Tax Affairs at the U.S. Treasury Department, joins us today from San Francisco. David Rosenblum, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
Is there a question about whether or not people are required to declare under the law money in offshore accounts?
Well, U.S. persons, U.S. citizens, and residents
yeah.
are required by law to declare their worldwide income. There is a tax protester movement which maintains that there's no such requirement, but legally there is.
You've dealt with people who have money in offshore accounts, maybe like these. What's the profile?
Well, I think the profile is more more varied than you might imagine.
Mm-hmm.
My firm has about 350 of these accounts, clients. I have a small piece of that. But the accounts come in a lot of varieties. You have some people who've gone to great lengths to hide their accounts, but you also have some people who've inherited money. There's a lot of inherited accounts, and in some of those cases, the people haven't paid much attention. I think in the back of their
mind, may have inherited a Swiss bank account and just never sort of thought twice about it?
Exactly.
That sounds
exactly.
A little easy, like, oh, gee, you mean I really was supposed to pay attention to that?
I think in the back of their minds, they know that they're required to pay, but it's not something that they focused on. And in some cases, you also have to realize that there are a lot of these people who live abroad. I have a woman mm-hmm. right now, for example, who's working in Switzerland and who puts her salary in a savings account. She never declared it, so she's obviously in violation. But in fact, it's about as innocent as you can get in this this category of people.
Except she's not paying the taxes she's required to. Is your firm getting people calling in? I don't know, crying, weeping, wondering whether they're have to go in and fess up and pay what are pretty substantial fines, even under this amnesty today?
Yes, there's a wide range of risk tolerance. Some people are scared to death. They're going to go right to jail if they come forward, if they don't come forward. Some people are laying back in the weeds. My own suspicion is that a lot of large account holders are waiting to see what happens.
Carrick Mullenkamp, what do you know about that? Are these people who are going to play the odds and just hope that the IRS doesn't get to them?
See, I think that's fascinating. I would have thought the large account holders would be in discussions with the IRS thinking that they could probably stomach paying the fine and the taxes owed. But if the big account, it seems like if the big account holders are in the weeds waiting and they know they've structured it with fictional entities in Hong Kong,
mm-hmm.
That's a pretty interesting gamble. I mean, we haven't seen the 7,500 that have come forward. Unless they want to talk to the media, or,
mm-hmm.
we undoubtedly really won't know who they are. We've seen about a handful of guilty pleas. We haven't seen kind of a big name yet. So if there's a big account holder with fictional accounts and they're trying to play the odds, it's pretty interesting.
I'm reading here about accounts in volumes from $1 million to $100 million. I guess part of the deal is if you come in under the amnesty, you don't get publicly named, so you avoid the embarrassment of that.
Right. The only time you're going to see it is if there's a guilty plea or a criminal prosecution. And there's some difference of opinion, I think, inside Treasury and the IRS and DOJ about whether they would publicize a guilty plea. I think there's been a difference of opinion on whether I think justice has been willing to maybe not publicize it, where the IRS and Treasury have wanted to kind of cite these guilty pleas. Yep. It certainly helped people come forward.
David K. Johnston, you've done a lot of work in these in this area. How do you read the mentality of people who may have a lot of money stashed in these accounts but are ready to play the odds? Of not being sort of caught out somehow. What's the mentality that brought them there in the first place that might be at work there?
Well, you have a whole host of people here, as David Rosenblum pointed out. Some of them are, in fact, people who have accounts they inherited, they live offshore, they have family offshore. I would distinguish those people from people who engaged in calculated efforts to hide. Those people are inherently risk takers. So it shouldn't be terribly surprising that we're not going after them. And remember that under the agreement with the Swiss, once they've told us about less than 10% of the accounts, and we don't know what they are, and there's a 370-day deadline,
mm-hmm.
they're not telling us anymore. So we could end up with 4,500 accounts that are relatively insignificant in terms of the effort made to violate the law and hide money. And I think that's one of the real problems with the effort that we're seeing. We need to focus on those people who were actively, deliberately, knowingly cheating.
So there's a kind of gamble here that people can take, that maybe their name won't be among the names that the Swiss hand over and they're willing to play perhaps those odds. David Rosenblum, why did the U.S. cut that deal with the Swiss? Why didn't they ask for all the names? Or to turn it around, why did the Swiss, after so many years of maintaining banking secrecy, why did they crack and reveal this time?
Well, the key thing on the Swiss side is that the United States had brought a summons enforcement action in Florida against UBS. And I think as a legal matter, if that had gone to judgment, the IRS would have won that. And that could well have put UBS out of business or very seriously jeopardized.
And this is a huge bank.
Right. And the Swiss were not prepared to live with that. On the U.S. side, I think the deal here is that the U.S. agreed to abandon the summons enforcement action and to proceed under the bilateral tax convention, which seems like a huge concession, but it's got to be part of that deal that the U.S. obtained the ability to go after other financial institutions. In other words, I suspect that part of the deal is that the U.S. can request information not only with respect to UBS, but with respect to other institutions that aren't present in the United States and therefore not subject to a summons enforcement action.
We'll look at more at how big a crackdown this really is or not. Brad in Concord, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Brad.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think we should throw these guys in jail and prosecute them the full extent of the law. If we throw kids in jail for selling crack and ruin their lives, these guys are making just as much social impact by not paying their fair share. I just wonder how many guys from Goldman will end up in the hookah there.
Social impact, what, because they're enjoying the advantages of life in the United States but not helping pay the freight?
That's exactly right. We have a lot of money that's being sucked out of this economy right now, and we need every dime.
Brad, thanks for calling. Megan in New Haven, Connecticut. Megan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My point is that the rich will stay rich, and if you push them to pay every tax and watch for every penny, they'll just leave the country and take their business, their real estate, the jobs that they provide us by being rich by what they purchase to another country like we have seen in Holland and Germany.
Hard to take the real estate, but... I mean, if we don't stay on top of it, maybe the money just, as Brad says, maybe the money does go abroad and we don't have the capital we need in this country for investment, Megan.
Yeah, well, I just know that what's happened in Holland and Germany, although I don't know the details, is that when the government tried to crack down on every penny in taxes, people just took their business as well as their livelihoods to other countries.
Let us pick it up. David K. Johnston, how about that perspective? Lay off, or the rich will just take the money and go.
Well, I don't think we're going to see that happen. The fact is most all around the world, you have people who want to come to the United States. There are a handful of people who've done this and have moved to other places under very lax rules that we have. This is still the biggest market in the world and will continue to be one of the largest markets in the world long after we're gone. However, Megan raises an important point I would approach from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Under our current tax law, we actually reward companies for moving assets offshore and investing offshore and creating jobs offshore. That's a crazy tax policy. We have this idea, which is embedded in news reports you hear every day, that the American economy is about consumption rather than production. And we need to get a fundamental change in our national culture so that we think about building assets, building wealth, creating jobs that are based on economic productive activities rather than this idea that the whole point of America is to be able to consume.
But you've got to have capital to invest and you've got to have – I mean, the rich pay a big chunk of American taxes as it is. We know that. But, of course, they make a big chunk of American income. If the money just runs abroad, the American economy needs that fuel, doesn't it?
Well, yes. But, Tom, a little fact to keep in mind. The top 1% of Americans you will often hear pay 40% of the income taxes. That's true but incredibly misleading. The top 1% of Americans make 23% of the income and they pay about 26% of the total taxes.
Mm-hmm.
That's not much disparity. And in large parts of this country, you can see the evidence of this, that we have built up these enormous financial resources at the top that are not being put into productive uses. They're being put into unproductive and, as Wall Street has shown us in many cases, anti-productive uses. What we need to do is design a tax system that encourages investment and productivity. But I do not accept at all the notion that, gee, the tax burden is too heavy, therefore I have some right to cheat. In that case, you are saying basically you believe the system, you should behave immorally. I don't think you can make a moral case for what Megan has just argued.
It's hard to wave the flag and then not help pay for the troops and the roads and everything else, but that's what has gone on right here. David Rosenblum, you're the attorney here. Your firm represents people doing this. Is there any reason the U.S. shouldn't sort of crack down full bore on this undeclared wealth abroad? Shouldn't that I mean, if that's the law, shouldn't it be tracked?
Well, there's a reason why they can't as opposed to shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
The problem here is IRS resources. David K. Johnston put his finger on it early on in this conversation. The IRS really doesn't have the resources to do what it set out to do here. And the initiative that it took, which ends today, October 15, was designed to sort of shake the tree and have people do it, do the work themselves of coming in and coming forward. If the IRS had to really track these folks down, you'd need a lot larger budget than you've got right now. And it's a little bit of a mystery to me why the IRS is terminating the initiative right now, because we've always had a voluntary disclosure policy in this country for decades. And one thing you ought to know is that after October 15, after today, there's going to be a voluntary disclosure policy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going to be different from this initiative that the IRS took. That's why when you talk about people taking a risk of not coming forward, this is not the end of the story. This story has got probably years to play out.
Well, what do you mean terminating the initiative? I thought the deal was come forward for a lesser fine now or face investigation and prosecution and big fines and even jail time if you don't.
No, let me explain. Mm-hmm. There's always been a voluntary disclosure policy,
right,
that was oriented toward criminal penalties only. With respect to these foreign bank accounts, the IRS initiated a separate program within the voluntary disclosure program, and it's that separate program that's coming to an end on October 15. That program was oriented not only toward criminal penalties, but also toward civil penalties, and it's that that's coming to an end. But when that stops, there's still going to be voluntary disclosure with respect to criminal prosecution. That's been around for a long, long time, and it applies to many kinds of activities besides putting money in foreign bank accounts. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who are skimming money from businesses, for example. It has nothing to do with a foreign bank account. That's criminal, too. People come forward and make voluntary disclosures. IRS is not going to stop that. So we're going to have something after today. It's just not clear what it's going to be.
Chris in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. You're on the air, Chris.
Oh, yeah, Tom. First of all, I just want to say thank you for taking the call. I listen to the show on my way to school up here in Nashville. Just had a quick question for your guests. I don't pretend to completely understand how this whole thing works, but I've been trying to follow up on it. And mm-hmm. the point I want to make is, you know, this offshore banking thing has obviously been going on for ages. Will this IRS initiative really stop it, or is it simply just going to halt it for a while? Because, let's be honest, Americans are the best at finding a way around the system.
David K. Johnston, how do you answer that question? Is this a roadblock or just a bump in the road?
Well, we're going in the right direction, but this is a long way from solving the problems here. I think Americans are beginning to realize that the virtual guarantee that you were safe in the past is gone. And, Tom, I would like to point out one important thing about those people who come forward.
Mm-hmm.
And don't want to get too far down in the weeds, but Article 4 and Article 6 of our agreement with the Swiss that leads to all of this contains in it the suggestion that the Swiss, when they turn over names, may tell you. They may say, Mr. Ashbrook, we want you to know with your $100 million account, you're one of the people whose name we gave to the IRS. So the people coming forward mm-hmm. may well be people who know that they were selected to be turned over, and therefore this program may not be, in case of the really calculated cheats, as much voluntary disclosure as it would appear on the surface.
Are they going to select for that the really big cats here, or the sort of the little vulnerable guys? Are they going to protect
the fat cats? They're going to give a few big ones up for sure. And many of us who follow this stuff, you know, have looked with fascination at the decision by the Swiss to suddenly arrest Roman Polanski, you know, on a 30-year-old crime, and whether this was part of an effort to sort of show, see, we really do believe in the rule of law.
Mm.
But yes, I would expect the Swiss to turn over a few.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. A little later in this hour, we're going to talk about the Dow Jones Industrial Average at 10,000. But right now, we're talking about tax evaders, the billions hidden in offshore tax havens, and the IRS move to crack down. Today is the deadline for hidden offshore account holders to come clean. With Ferrick Molenkamp, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, David K. Johnston, who's followed these issues for many, many years very prominently, and H. David Rosenblum, an attorney, tax attorney at Kaplan and Drysdale in New York, joining us today from San Francisco. Nick in Greenwich, Connecticut. Hi, Nick, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I'm one of those privileged people who makes a high income, and there's several million of us, and most of us do pay our taxes.
Thank you very much.
I just think that shouldn't be forgotten. These other folks who are not paying their taxes are obviously improper and should be punished to the full extent of the law. But everybody shouldn't be painted with the same brush.
Very fair indeed. I take your point, Nick. You're there in Greenwich. Do you know people who have money in offshore accounts? Or can you imagine why they would?
If anybody did, I can't imagine they would tell somebody. But I certainly know an awful lot of my friends who pay significant taxes and are not upset with it. They wish the government would spend it as wisely as the effort that was put in to make it.
They and everybody else. David K. Johnston, while we've got Nick, this is kind of in your bailiwick, and he's saying, you know, don't use too broad a brush here. On the other hand, you've got some pretty inflammatory book titles yourself, you know, The Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves and Stick You with the Bill. What do you say to Nick's point, David?
Well, Nick's exactly right, and I say that in my books. There's no question that we have a progressive income tax structure until you get to a very high level. People at the top 400 taxpayers whose average income was $266 million pay taxes at the same rate as people who make $50,000 to $75,000. But until you get up to over $10 million a year of annual income, and mostly then from capital, we have a progressive tax structure, and we tax people substantially at those levels. And I'm always very careful also to point that out. Mm-hmm. But there is a minority of people who exploit the system, who collect subsidies left and right. In some cases, we have whole industries in America that derive all their profits from hidden subsidies.
Carrick, you've done the reporting on UBS, who was sending folks out literally to yacht clubs and wine tastings and art shows. And they were quite explicit, it turns out, if the whistleblower is right, in trying to subvert the thing Nick's talking about. Nick's talking about having money, making money, and going on the straight and narrow. But UBS was explicitly saying, bring your money over here and we can help you protect it from the tax man.
Yeah, Mr. Rosenblum might be able to cover this point. I mean, there may be a defense that some of the clients were financially naive and thought this was okay. I'm not sure that would cover many of the people. What also ramped this up was around 2001 after, I think David had referred to one of the treaties, after the U.S. and Swiss agreed to a deal where the Swiss would produce the reports on these people. The banks actually would produce the reports. UBS, in what became kind of a famous meeting in Zurich, brought in outside advisors to effectively say, can you design ways around this deal that we have struck with the U.S.? And you're seeing a lot in the guilty pleas where the outside advisors or bankers that left UBS to go to other Swiss banks devised some of these schemes. So you saw a ramp up after 2001.
I mean, you had Bradley Birkenfeld, the whistleblower, who's headed to prison even so early next year. But he told Senate investigators, he said this was a massive machine. And he described UBS bankers crisscrossing the U.S. without licensing from the SEC to find wealthy customers. He said you might go to car shows, wine tastings. You might deal with real estate agents. You might deal with attorneys. It's really where do the rich people hang out, go and talk to them? What was the message, David Rosenblum? It appears it was quite explicit. Protect your money from legally obligated tax commitments.
Yeah, I think what was going on, I think Carrick put his finger on what was going on there. The Swiss bank, well, UBS and maybe others, entered into these agreements with IRS. They're called qualified intermediary agreements, whereby they would collect information from their depositors and turn it over to the U.S., and so the bankers hit on a method whereby if you put some kind of a shell corporation between the investor and the account, you could avoid, on their view, you could avoid having to file these things. So the bankers would come to the U.S. and would try to persuade people to restructure their accounts to put, say, a Panamanian company between them and the account.
Or Cayman Islands or Liechtenstein, Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm. Sure, any of those places. Mm-hmm. And that basically was criminal activity on U.S. soil, I might add. But, I mean, that's why you asked earlier what leverage we had. The United States had huge leverage because UBS was committing crimes, U.S. crimes, on U.S. soil.
And diamonds in a toothpaste tube? Why? What would that even be about? Just to get it out of the country undeclared?
Well, I think they were basically trying to hide the reasons that they were in the United States. I mean, they basically were very surreptitious in the way that they came over. They said that they were coming over for tourism reasons or vacations, and basically they were coming over to meet with the clients and professionals. By the way, I don't think we're anywhere near the bottom of what happened here. I would suspect that there was a lot more activity by UBS and possibly other Swiss institutions. I don't know that for a fact, but I think there's a lot more activity than has been publicized today.
Well, what we're seeing, if I can just follow up on that point, is where the UBS banker or the banker that had recently left UBS would arrive and meet with the clients with a lawyer as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that may have provided some legitimacy to that meeting and that structure. I think in the U.S., though, to Mr. Rosenblum's point about not getting to the bottom of things, there may be some U.S. attorneys that may find themselves in the crosshairs of the IRS because they may have offered fairness opinions on some of these structures or legal advice that gave the U.S. citizens some comfort. And I think we may see some prosecution against U.S. tax lawyers that may have provided this advice.
I mean, it's basically an issue of equity, right? I mean, lots of people may not want to pay as much tax as they do or wonder about where it's going, but until we change the law, this is the system, and it's, I guess, not fair for those who don't play by the rules. But Adrian, Lincoln, Rhode Island, you're on the air.
Yeah. I think the only legitimate function of my government is to defend my inalienable rights to my life, my liberty, my money. And much of what the government does is transfers, taking from those who have earned it to give to those who have not. I wish I would be in a position to...
But how will they defend those rights if people aren't chipping in? Let's say, just talking about defense, for the military.
That is a legitimate function, and that would only take a fraction of what the government takes now from us.
So you see it as civil disobedience when people hide money in Swiss bank accounts?
In a way it is, yes. They want to prevent my government from doing things they should not be doing.
Adrian, thanks for your call. David K. Johnston, how about a noble stance, civil disobedience?
Absolutely, and as long as you're willing to step forward, as people do, and say, I'm going to violate this law to test it, and you're prepared to go to jail, I think that's a perfectly moral stand to take. Doing it in secret and colluding, that's immoral. There's no two ways about it. And by the way, the caller is wrong. Most of the government money the government takes is not income transference, particularly if you think about it in terms of time. That is, there were people long gone now who paid taxes so that you and I could go to school when we were children. You and I now pay taxes so that other people's children go to school. Those are simply time transfers. They're not actual transfers. We got a benefit, and we paid for the benefit later. Most of the government spending is on other things. The biggest items being interest on the national debt, which is because of taxes we didn't pay for services that we got, and the military.
And those are big bills to pay, and somebody's got to pay them. And if it comes right out of your weekly paycheck, you're not going to be hiding it anywhere, David.
Right.
Garrick Mullenkamp, so where does this go now? Today, what is it? Sometime later today, the deadline, the gate comes down. And then those who haven't stepped forward just have to wait and see whether an investigator shows up at their door and they have to pay the big penalty?
Well, I think there are kind of two parallel tracks. I mean, so today's the deadline. What we potentially may see now is probably before the end of the year, a couple more guilty pleas, I would think, or criminal indictments as those cases start to kind of now percolate. David made a good point earlier that the DOJ and IRS are limited in how many they can prosecute, so it's not going to be a lot coming forward. And then we'll see where the IRS gets to. The IRS yesterday said they're opening offices in places like Beijing. They're focusing on Panama, Barbados, and so forth. So they're trying to widen the net. At the same time, they're trying to keep up with this flood of people that have come forward. I think the next kind of turn of events will be a criminal prosecution, maybe at least one, but before the end of the year.
David Rosenblum, last word goes to you. Do you see a new day here where this is just going to be less popular, less possible, or just a hiccup?
I think that there's still going to be plenty of offshore accounts after this. There are lots of jurisdictions that the U.S. has no leverage over. But I repeat that there's got to be something after today. In other words, we're not going from having a full-blown initiative in place to having nothing. For one thing, under the UBS settlement, there are still thousands of names to be turned over. In fact, the first names haven't been turned over to the United States yet at all. All that's happened there is that letters have been sent out to these people saying that their names would be turned over, and only about half of the potential people have received those letters. So I don't think we're going to a situation where there's nothing.
So stay tuned. There may be more with more names attached on this front. H. David Rosenblum at Kaplan and Drysdale in New York, joining us today from San Francisco. Thank you very much, Attorney Rosenblum, for being here.
You're welcome.
David K. Johnston, it's always great to have you with us, author of Free Lunch and Perfectly Legal. David, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Carrick Molenkamp with The Wall Street Journal. Thank you for your reporting, Carrick.
Thanks, Tom.
In a moment, a milestone on Wall Street. This is On Point. The Dow Jones hit 10,000 again yesterday. Wall Street celebrated, but we've been here before, so what does it mean? Robin Farzad joins us from New York. He's a senior writer for Business Week magazine. Robin, thanks very much for joining us.
Tom, how are you?
I'm good. 10,000. We've been there before. We first hit it in the late 90s. We're obviously after the bubble, the dot-com bubble crash, came back to it not so long ago, and now here we are in 2009. How's the number, first of all, being received on Wall Street? Does it mean something, nothing, anything?
It's being received in a kind of a muted response. After all, we did cross this threshold. It was a milestone the first time around 10 years ago, but it's kind of pitiful that we've had to round trip like this. The market has had its worst decade in almost a century, and it's been a bad 20 and 30 years as well.
So it's pitiful in one sense. In another, if you look back just a year ago, people may be amazed. I mean, we were, in March of this year, we're down at 6,547, the Dow. Last fall, nobody knew where the collapse might take us. There must be relief as well.
Relief, and if you want to dwell on that March number, I think March 9th was the low when it hit about 6,400, 6,500 mm-hmm. maybe. And that, not only in nominal terms, that's a level we haven't seen since 1996, before Alan Greenspan gave his irrational, exuberant speech. But in a story we did recently, in inflation-adjusted terms, that's a level we haven't seen since 1966. So as if to say, you know, the Internet has meant nothing, the microwave oven has meant nothing, morning in America, all that jazz, it's like 40 years down the drain.
Now, you're saying it meant nothing because if it really meant something and that value was socked away in our overall national value, the Dow should theoretically have just been marching forward on the basis of rationally assessed value.
But it's never rational in the short term. There's a great saying out there, the market can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. And we've seen that in spades this decade, not only with the Internet bubble, but following that credit and mortgage alchemy and what we've seen in the past year. A lot of people could have made a very rational argument that the market was fairly valued in the springtime when we were sweeping away all of the fluff, mm-hmm. all of the alchemy of subprime. But in fact, the market is gone on to stage its best rally, I think, in 70 years. I mean, it's up almost 60% since March. So I would caution against, slicing and dicing it the way we did so many bad mortgages.
Right. Of course, it's still way below that 2007 high of over 14,000. And the thing that's turned people's heads, and you've been writing about this, is that the so-called equity risk premium, which said stocks perform better than bonds over time, even with this march up, when you look back over a considerable stretch now, the long term, that equity risk premium, the wise guys, insight that stocks are better over time, is in trouble even now.
It's failed a generation, that argument, unfortunately. And you could have done, you could have done better in kind of arguably risk-free treasuries with a heck of a lot less Mylanta in that period. And that's really what has so many professional investors and even academics scratching their heads. They're saying, do we need to rewrite the history books? Do we need to rewrite Econ 101 and Investing 101? But that remains to be seen if this is an aberration like 1987 or it's more a period like that following the crash of 29 when we had almost a 20-year dead time for stocks.
It can seem almost irrelevant when there's 10% unemployment, and yet a lot of Americans, one way or another, have a lot invested in the stock market, whether they like it or not. What are the schools of thought now? Here we are, right around 10,000. What's the school that says this can go further, and what's the opposite? What's the opposite view now?
There's a school called the New Normal, which is kind of out of Newport Beach, California. If you follow PIMCO, it's by far the largest bond manager in the mm-hmm. world. They're saying that what kind of fantasy is the market romancing, that you have 10% unemployment, huge gains in job losses, and the Fed at zero interest rate policy kind of pushing out a string, and you have the stock market with this record run.
So they're not buying the bullish
view. No, they're absolutely
view.
Not buying it, and they're saying that if anything, people are going to have to reset their expectations far lower. The stock market's going to be a disappointment. You're going to have to worry about rampant inflation in certain economies, the demise of the dollar. But then there are others are saying that this is just the new normal is, in fact, the old normal in different clothing, that foreigners and emerging economies are going to pick up the slack for the overextended U.S. consumer. And, in fact, American companies' stocks arguably see almost, what, two-fifths of their sales abroad. So, in the end, it's kind of a wash.
And they're saying 10,000 could, once again, just be the beginning?
A lot of them are saying 10,000 is just the beginning, that, in fact, there's a lot of room to recover. The question is, I asked myself when I started that story, when was it normal? Can we pick a year where the stock market was, you know, didn't have the benefit or the lag of certain aberrations coming in, whether it was 9/11 or Paul Volcker coming in and slashing right. interest rates in the early 80s with hyperinflation? I think it's always, it always does seem different, and it always seems like this is a departure and a perforation from the past.
Robin Farzad, we're out of time at Business Week. Thank you for joining us, Robin. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.